little retreat we have here Friday. As Jim said, the theme is dana paramita, dana parami, and dana means generosity. And this Friday's retreat is something I do about once a month or so. It's kind of a time to explore the Dharma in some other way besides sitting. We do some sitting, we do some guided meditations, we have some discussions, sometimes we do some reading, some exercises, we hang out, get to know each other. It's kind of a rich experience. And for the next year, it's not going to be every month, but for next year, when I do these Dharma practice days on Friday, it's going to have a theme of the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections. And so this coming Friday is the first one, which is the perfection of generosity. And then what I'd like to do this evening is to use this evening as a opportunity to introduce the concept of the paramis. And then as we go through this year on Fridays, the Monday after the Friday of the I'll probably give a talk Monday night on that particular parami here. Maybe next week I'll give a talk on generosity, since generosity is this Friday. And then in a month I'd do the second one, and so we go be like a series of winds through the year. And so I'd like to give the introduction today to this topic of the paramis. And it's a very important one for people who are engaged in Buddhist spirituality, and provides the context, support, the expression of kind of the growth that happens in people as they engage in Buddhist spiritual life. So the first thing I'd like to do is to give you the list of the 10. And then I'll explain. If I explain first, then I would maybe pollute your minds, corrupt your minds with ideas of what they are. So what I thought I'd do is just go through the list quietly, just state the concept, the quality. It's a quality of heart. It's a quality of character, of being. And then as I say them, why don't you see if you can... what it resonates inside of you. Do you recognize it in yourself? Do you have this quality inside yourself? Is it a quality that of yourself that you value? Is it a quality of yourself that you have but you tend to overlook? Is it a quality that you can't find in yourself? It has no relationship or relevance to your life. And it's a foreign idea. And if it does resonate with you, then let it resonate for a while. Kind of maybe repeat the word to yourself. Let it go sink into your heart or into your mind, or see what is aroused in your mind and hearts, bodies, by hearing these particular ideas or qualities. So the first quality is that of generosity. And the second is virtue. The third is renunciation. Can you hear? I can't hear out there. Somehow it changed. Renunciation or letting go. And the fourth is wisdom. The fifth is energy or strength. The sixth is patience. The seventh is truth, truthfulness. And the eighth is determination. The ninth is loving kindness. And the tenth is equanimity. So these 10 are called the 10 paramis. Paramis is a Pali word. It's usually translated into English as the perfections, the 10 perfections. Sometimes people know them by their Sanskrit word, paramita, the paramitas, very important in Mahayana Buddhism. And sometimes they're considered ornaments of the heart. They adorn the heart when they're present. They make the heart beautiful. And they're very interesting qualities. Now, there's a few people now, but I think it started with Robert Thurman, a Tibetan teacher, who threw up his hands one day or some point, is that these Buddhists, all they ever talk about is practice, practice, practice. When are we going to have the performance? Now, it hadn't occurred to me that we are practicing to perform, like entertainment. I thought we were practicing like, you know, practicing medicine. You know, that's the idea of practice. But in any case, when's the performance? And the idea of performance points out to the very important concept that it's crucial to express our realization, to manifest, give manifestation, give expression to our understanding, to the way we're changed, the way we grow in the spiritual life. And that's important to emphasize, because some people emphasize a lot the coming to a place of letting go, coming to a place of peace or calm, coming to a place of personal transformation and change, and they kind of hold it really close to themselves. They kind of make kind of a private world or kind of something which is just kind of involves an inner change, but not something that is acted on or expressed in the world or manifested. And there are Buddhist teachers who actually don't put a lot of value. I would say this way. They say something like, you know, realization is pretty easy. What's difficult is to manifest it in the world. And that's really the manifesting of your practice is really what's important. Now the question is, how is realization manifested? How is it expressed? And these 10 paramis are some of the ways in which realization flows through a person into the life they relive. So someone who has attained a freedom of heart, a freedom of mind, is someone who would almost naturally live a life of generosity. They'd be open-handed, live a life that's open-handed. Someone who has done away with all conflicts and all drivenness in their hearts, all compulsion, would live ethically, would live have virtue. That such a person would practice letting go in a healthy way, in a wise way, which is a fourth character, to have some level of wisdom. That wisdom would characterize their actions in the world. There would be effort or energy or strength as part of that quality. It's not just the person doesn't just become kind of a enlightened blob, you know, enlightened couch potato, but actually would exhibit certain level of strength, of personal power. And there would be a lot of patience with how things are. There would be a dedication to truth. It would be possible for someone who's fully realized to lie, because that just goes, just, there isn't a place in the heart that would have that impulse to lie. And there would be some level of determination or resolve or kind of commitment, some strength of follow through with things that are important. And then there would be loving kindness and there would be equanimity. Now, what's I find fascinating about this is that whereas these things are seen as kind of the manifestation or the expression of realization, they're also seen as the foundation and support for realization. So people who want to develop their spiritual life in Buddhism, develop their meditation practice, it's very helpful to have developed these perfections, these qualities, these inner qualities. And the stronger these qualities are, the easier it is to do the deep work of meditation or the deep work of realization. And it's quite common in the Theravadan tradition to point out to someone who reaches an impasse in the practice or somehow can't practice, or is to say, oh, what you need to do is maybe stop practicing, but go develop these paramis, some parami for a while. Develop this power, the strength of inner qualities that comes with developing the parami. So maybe you need to develop your generosity, or develop your ability to be determined or have be resolute, or develop your loving kindness, or develop your commitment to truth. And so you develop these things, and then you can come back to the cushion, and they're going to carry you, support you, give you strength for the work that happens on the cushion. So what you see then is this beautiful circle, that the same things, the same activities, the same qualities of heart are both a support for meditation and for Buddhist spirituality, and they're an expression of the Buddhist spirituality fully grown. Follow that? So maybe you couldn't tell from the outside whether a person is realized or not, because they're acting the same, they're doing the same thing. So there's a kind of a unity or kind of coming together of the support for practice and the expression or manifestation of practice. The mythological, these 10 paramis as a list didn't appear in the earliest strata of Buddhism. The Buddha didn't teach them, but they appeared soon after he died and has become very important down through the centuries in almost all schools of Buddhism. And they appear in a myth that also appeared after the Buddha died, but they're kind of a myth, Buddhist myth, about when the Buddha first decided, when the person who became the Buddha first decided to dedicate himself to becoming a Buddha. And it's said that this happened in mythological time in a former rebirth. And actually, not just a former, but a rebirth that was many, many, many eons prior to the birth of Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha in historical times, in our historical times. And there was way back in the distant past, this person was born as Sumedha. And Sumedha was an ascetic. It's sometimes described that he wore robes made out of some kind of animal skin. And he had long matted hair. He was like a Rastafarian. And he lived up in the mountains in caves and just ate bark. Sometimes it says rather than deer clothes, he wore just bark clothes made out of bark. And then one day, he somehow heard that a Buddha had appeared. And that Buddha, back, way, way back, his name was Dipankara. Dipankara means the maker of light. And this Sumedha got very excited. A Buddha, you know, it's pretty rare to see a Buddha, you know. So we missed ours. He was 2,500 years ago. So, you know, he was born at a time of the Buddha, so he was kind of excited. So he decided to go visit this Buddha. And he went to town because Buddha was supposed to come to town. And as the Buddha approached down the road, people were making offerings to the Buddha. And he was really, really impressed by the sight of the Buddha. And in seeing that Buddha, he decided that he would not simply become an ordinary enlightened person, but rather become the kind of enlightened person who's a Buddha. Buddha is someone who's not only enlightened, but is enlightened with a lot of strong personal qualities. So they bring these amazing qualities to bear on their work of teaching other people. Also, a Buddha is also someone who's very unique in that a Buddha is someone who discovers the path by him or herself. So that the Buddha usually appears in this mythology in a world system, in a world, in a society, where there absolutely are no Buddhas. And so it's, you know, a big deal to be someone who has that capacity to discover these truths alone without having to, you know, having a teacher who tells you or books or a tradition. So he decided he was going to become a Buddha. As Dipankara Buddha was walking down the road, he wanted to make an offering. But he was an ascetic, he had nothing to give. He wasn't going to give his bark robe to the Buddha. But he had this long hair. And the road was kind of muddy, it had a mud puddle on the road. So he threw himself down on the road and flipped his hair down on top of the mud. So the Buddha wouldn't get dirty as he walked across the mud. He was walking on top of his thick matted hair. And so the Buddha, this Dipankara Buddha, saw Sumedha there on the ground and saw that he had the kind of personal qualities that would make a Buddha someday. And then he made a little prediction and said, sometime way down in the future, this fellow here will become Shakyamuni Buddha. And so he was very happy. Sumedha was very happy about this prediction. And he went back to his cave in the mountains. And then he contemplated what it would take to become a Buddha. And he saw that he would have to develop 10 qualities, these 10 paramis. Not just little bit, not just middling, but he had to bring them to perfection in him. And because only when they brought to full perfection would that person be ready for that final transformation that makes a person a Buddha. And he saw that it was going to take a long time to do that. And as the mythology plays itself out, it was going to take him four innumerable kalpas. Now, a kalpa is a very long time. A kalpa is so long that if you take a granite block that's one square cube, and once every 100 years, a maiden with a sari made in Varanasi came by and brushed that block. One kalpa is how long it takes to wear down that 1 mile square granite. Now it takes four, some people say three, some traditions say three, some takes four. And so if you're impatient, you do the 3-1. Number of these kalpas, eons, for a person to do all the practices and stuff that it takes to develop these perfections to the point that you can become a Buddha. And so then the Buddha, this guy, Sumedha, then in his next lifetimes, then started practicing these perfections. And there's these stories, kind of like Aesop fables kind of stories, of how the Buddha, in different lifetimes, perfected these different qualities. As the Theravada tradition developed in Southeast Asia, these 10 qualities began to be understood not only important for someone who wanted to become a Buddha, but for anybody who wanted to attain any degree of enlightenment at all, and any kind of enlightenment or realization. They needed to have these qualities to some degree. Now, some people are born with them, and then the Buddhists would say, well, that was last, you know, they'd been doing a couple of kalpas already. You know, the last lifetime they developed these. But who knows why certain people are born with certain kind of inner qualities and some are not. But some people are born with qualities that carry them, and some people develop them in the course of their lives. They have, they're taught certain qualities growing up. Qualities of generosity or kindness or truth-telling or something. And some people are, and need to, you know, develop them once they're adults. Some people never develop them, and because they don't have them, they become tremendous barriers to developing a spiritual life. I mean, could you imagine someone being able to get really deep in meditation and who has dedicated their life to lying or being cruel? It doesn't work, you know. They would just come up against this wall. They just wouldn't go any further. So as the Theravada tradition developed, then it became understood that anybody who wanted to develop some degree of spiritual maturation needed to have some of these qualities. You didn't have to perfect them to the degree needed to become a Buddha, but you need to have them a little bit. Now, what I find also fascinating about this is that someone who dedicates themselves to become a Buddha does so out of compassion for the suffering of the world in order to help others. That's really the underlying motivation that gives strength and power to someone wanting to become a Buddha. And the paramis, the paramitas, these paramis are qualities which are completely connected to that movement of compassion. It's ways of developing compassion and giving expression to compassion. And compassion is developed, expression of compassion is developed in these 10 qualities. So for someone, anybody who wants to develop some degree of realization, wants to take practice far enough to really be transformed, there has to be some quality of compassion that underlies their practice. Some people will actively cultivate and develop compassion. Some people just let it develop naturally, because sometimes as people practice and their hearts open, compassion comes along with the practice. What it means is that Buddhist spirituality is not developed in isolation from people around us. But really, it's something that we understand that gets developed in the field of our relationships with people. And this is something that's been overlooked by a lot of practitioners, especially here in the West, where we're kind of young, new to Buddhism. And there's plenty enough practitioners who've mostly been in it for, what's in it for me? You know, it's my practice, you know, get out of my way, I'm focusing, and don't make a sound. And don't bother me, whatever. And so there's a kind of keeping the world away. So it's, you know, developing themselves. And the suggestion in this kind of teaching is that if you develop your practice in too much isolation from other people, without some understanding that you're practicing in the context of a field of beings, that you can't really take your practice as far as it potentially goes. So, when the Buddha taught a spiritual life, he taught what he called a gradual path, which mimics very much the kind of gradual way in which human beings develop. Through childhood, human growth tends to be gradual. I wish it was otherwise, but you know, I have a 6-year-old, and I have to be patient. You know, things grow slowly, and I can't rush it. Expect to be different, but I'm sure that, you know, there was a time where I just couldn't believe he was ever going to get toilet trained. I mean, how is this going to happen? And I'd remind myself, well, I don't know any 12-year-olds are still wearing diapers. I know it's going to happen, but I don't know how this is going to happen. And so slowly that does happen. These things, up to a certain point, human beings, as they're growing up, or maybe up until the point of death, there's a gradual change in development happens, maturation. And this natural maturation, which happens gradually, was the kind of was the model for how the Buddha presented the spiritual path to people. Because as he went around India, he met people on many different levels of personal development. And there were people who were kind of had almost no personal development at all, and some people who were very cultured or very developed. And so in presenting the teachings, and some people who were quite advanced, he could give the teachings very briefly and they'd have what's called maybe a sudden awakening. But for people who weren't so, you know, well developed, he would talk this gradual practice that would carry them along. And in teaching the gradual path, the first two qualities that he always taught had to do with our relationship to others around us. So rather than focusing on ourselves and our own suffering and our own development first, the Buddha always started with how we are in relationship to others as where the path begins. And that's seen in the ten paramis, where the first quality is generosity and the second is virtue or ethics. Both only make sense in relationship to other people for the most part. I guess you can be generous to yourself, but and you can be ethical to yourself. Some people lie to themselves. But the idea is that you have this, mostly it has to do with who you're in relationship with. And so the first practice that the Buddha taught, kind of the first Buddhist practice for people, is generosity. And you find in Asia a lot of people who will put a tremendous emphasis on their own personal practice of generosity. They take it very seriously. And so it's really amazing to be in Buddhist Asia and experience, be in the receiving end, for example, of this tremendous show of generosity from the people there. I was kind of humbled and inspired and encouraged and over and over again by the levels of generosity I received when I was practicing in Asia. And it's part of one of the reasons why IMC is organized in a field of generosity as well. We have this dana system here. We don't ask anybody to pay, because what we want, it's a first cardinal kind of practice of Buddhism is generosity. And so we've set up our center to kind of express that as kind of the first kind of way in which we're organized here as a field of generosity. And as people practice generosity, it puts them in relationship to others. And so then we have to kind of begin looking at our relationship to others and look at where there are some wrinkles or some difficulties is it healthy, our relationships? Are they in some ways a little bit unhealthy? How are they, our relationships with others? Because in order for generosity to develop, the relationship between people has to become healthy. There's unhealthy ways of giving, but that doesn't really develop a spiritual life. So we're put in this relationship in order of generosity so we can understand ourselves and work on ourselves and use that as a mirror to develop ourselves and as a way of understanding others, of seeing others, appreciating others, seeing where the need is, seeing understanding others, seeing the effect this has on others. And so we develop a sensitivity to the world around us. Same thing with ethics, that there's a sensitivity that develops then towards others and to our relationships to others. And so and one of the things that will do then, hopefully, is help support or strengthen the capacity for compassion. One of the things that's important to say about this is that I believe here in the West, there tends to be, in certain currents of Western thought, a sharp divide between self and other. And that's partly why altruism is very, being altruistic has a very strong current of thought in the West. And in India, especially with Indian Buddhism, they don't really have this concept of being altruistic. Westerners will read it into Buddhism, but they tend to read it into it. And the reason why altruism is not so big in India is that there isn't a sharp divide between self and other, as we have here in the West. And that plays itself out with the understanding that if we benefit ourselves, we're also going to be benefiting others. If we benefit ourselves in a healthy way, we're also benefiting others. I mean, if you go out and buy yourself a Porsche, you could think that as being self-benefit, but that's not, you know, what spiritual life is about, at least, spiritual benefit. So as you benefit yourself, you're benefiting others. And as you benefit others, you're benefiting yourself. So, and the Western idea of altruism sometimes lends itself to the idea that you're supposed to be altruistic and give up concern for yourself, your own well-being, to sacrifice yourself for the well-being of others. For your kids, or for your spouse, or for your God, or for your country, or for something. And in Buddhism, that line between self and other doesn't disappear. It's an important line, it's an important distinction. But it in terms of how we benefit each other and how we relate to each other, it gets blurry. If we benefit ourselves, we benefit others. If we benefit others, we benefit ourselves. So someone who dedicates themselves to spiritual life in Buddhism, and they might go off and practice by themselves alone for a long time, it's understood that their intense practice is also going to bring benefit to others around them, that there's a reciprocal relationship there. So the paramis are, that part of Buddhist teaching is an expression of that part of practice that has to do with our relationship to the world around us, and that we're not distinct and separate from others, and that we're practicing in a field of others, an interdependent, interconnected field, and that our compassionate concern within that field is an important quality to be developed in practice, if you want to take the practice as far as is possible. Now remember the story of Sumedha seeing Dipankara. So he saw that, he saw the Buddha walking down the road, and in seeing that Buddha, he was changed. He saw something. He saw a possibility. He saw a possibility that he can become a Buddha. There was once a lion cub, that was orphaned. Maybe never seen its parents. And a group of wild pigs adopted this lion cub. And this lion cub was raised by these pigs. And the lion cub thought she was a pig. I guess it'd be a lioness. Thought she was a pig. And a wild pig. And so she did pig things, you know, rolled around in the dirt and snorted and dug, you know, their snout in the ground got all mangy. And so things were just fine. You know, the lioness was quite happy, you know, living a life of her family and friends, the wild pigs. Until one day, some lions came around. A lion came around. Another lioness. And who had, you know, really knew how to be a lioness, you know, strong and, you know, majestic the way some lions can be, and you know, knew how to do lion things and roar. And that pig, that black lioness who thought she was a pig, looked and said, "Wow." And the visiting lion said, "You know, you're not a pig." I said, "Oh, I see that now. I'm a lion, lioness. Oh." And suddenly she stood 3 inches taller. You know, so recognizing ourselves in someone else is sometimes very important. And so the story of Sumedha recognizing himself in Dipankara, Buddha, recognizing a potential, a quality, something, an aspect of who he was very important for him. It was part of the transformation. To learn to recognize somehow or other by seeing it in others and having it reflected back, or there's other ways perhaps of seeing it, but to recognize that we all have these beautiful qualities inside of us. Some traditions would say sacred qualities, some people would say maybe divine qualities, some people, I don't know, Buddha qualities, but these beautiful qualities inside our own hearts. And they're not separate from who we are. I kind of believe they reside there in everybody's heart, even though they're covered over or forgotten, or atrophied for some people. But they're there to be cultivated and found. And sometimes learning to recognize them and see them in others is a way of beginning to see the possibility in ourselves. So to learn and see the possibility of being generous, not giving. Giving is too narrow of a word because that's an act. But generosity is a state, to be generous, to feel generous. Virtue is very different than maybe morality or rules. Virtue is a state. It's a beautiful state. It's a state that's said to adorn the heart, make it beautiful. Not just for other people, but for ourselves. Letting go, renunciation, which we'll talk about in maybe 3 months. And only then, hopefully, you'll understand, it's really beautiful. It's really a fantastic, beautiful quality of heart. Until then, you can just kind of bracket that. But some people say, wait a minute, renunciation? That's not for me. And then, now renunciation requires a lot of wisdom. And that's why wisdom is the fourth one. Wisdom perfects renunciation. And then strength, quality of strength or effort, is something that we all can cultivate and develop. And that requires patience to perfect energy or strength or effort. So the effort is good. Truth-telling. I meet people. It really inspires me to meet people who somehow, early in life, have a tremendous dedication to truth. Sometimes I meet this in children sometimes. I don't know how they got it, but I wish I could knew how to teach my son. Is there a way to teach this to people? They just feel so bad. They feel somehow violated themselves in telling a lie, that they have this dedication to being truthful. And truthfulness is perfected by the eighth quality, which is a determination. There's a connection between living a determined life, standing by your truth, and truth. And then the ninth quality is loving kindness. And then then loving kindness is perfected by equanimity. Isn't that beautiful? I think it's beautiful. So we cultivate this powerful expression of loving kindness, kindness and care for others. But to bring it to perfection, you also cultivate equanimity. Equanimity doesn't dampen the loving kindness, but perfects it. Part of the importance of these 10 paramis is that they are qualities that can be practiced and developed in daily life. Some of the other qualities that Buddhists want to develop and cultivate often are developed in meditation practice or on retreat. And you can't develop some of these meditation things in your daily life as you go about so easily. But in daily life is understood to be a prime time to develop the paramis. And so people who want to find some way of integrating or developing or dedicating themselves to practice in daily life will often focus on these 10 perfections, maybe one at a time. One a month, maybe, just developing them and looking at it and reading and studying it like we're going to do. Or maybe once a year, one a year, or one a lifetime. It's up to you. And the idea here is not to add something to your life, not to burden yourself with something, but to find a way to unburden yourself, find a way to, in a sense, subtract that which hinders the expression of these beautiful qualities that are in each of our hearts. So my hope is that each of you will encounter some equivalent of a lion or a lioness. And in doing that, realize who you are. So that's the paramis. And I'll wait for your gurus.